We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL, Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. Photos of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico show us the disastrous impact it's having on the wildlife, water, marshes, and beaches of the region. The owner of the deep underwater well and others face lawsuits for the economic losses sustained. But what of the environment itself? What of the pelicans? Should they have standing to sue? Our guest this morning is Christopher Stone. He's the author of Should Trees Have Standing? Law, Morality, and the Environment. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You may join us by phone or by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Christopher Stone is a professor of law at the University of Southern California. He's an authority on international environmental law, including trade and the environment and environmental ethics. The third edition of his book, Should Trees Have Standing? Law, Morality, and the Environment, is now available from the Oxford University Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Christopher Stone, welcome. How are you?
Just fine.
Well, to begin with, this morning I thought it would be useful to talk about standing and what that means. What does it mean to have standing?
To have standing means that a case can be brought in court in your name and to your benefit and examining damages to you. In an era in which there's slavery, a slave might be indirectly protected against being beaten, but only by a suit brought by the slave's owner for losses of the benefit of the slave. Whereas in a jurisdiction that presently gives slaves standing or denies slavery, the slave can sue when the slave wants to sue for the slave's benefit, and the damages to be measured by the damages that the slave has suffered, including the pain and suffering, and not just to the lost employment value to the slave owner. For a long time, the environment's been treated like the slave.
Yeah, well, where are we now? Because we're sort of in a middle space, it seems to me, because we do have environmental law. We have the Clean Water Act, for example, and we have agencies set up to protect the environment, an agency like the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yes, there's clearly more, there's been more protection of the environment, but in many respects, the environment may be more vulnerable and needing more protection. The Clean Water Act and some of the environmental legislation dates back to the Nixon administration and remedied some of the worst offenses that we're aware of. But we're doing a lot to the environment that we may not be aware of. In your show this morning, the national news on NPR talks about the loss of the damage to the wildlife and the marshes and tidal pools and so forth, which is very important. But my concern extends to the chemistry of the ocean. I mean, I'm not sure what this spill does to multicellular organisms, to the acidity of the ocean. And these losses are barely on the radar of the law and may be the most dangerous.
Yeah. Among the Gulf oil stories reported is the story about the impact of oil plumes on life in the deep, deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico. And there's so much that's not known about deep sea ecosystems. So how do you go to bat for ecosystems that are not charted or poorly understood?
Well, the attention is being given to the features of the environment, if I can put it that way, that are have most apparently been injured, the sea turtles that have oil on them as endangers their breathing and digestion, the birds with it have gotten oil on them and put them in jeopardy since they can't fly. Those damages will be attended to under the Oil Pollution Act. That is, the Oil Pollution Act does provide some standing for the environment, some voice for the environment. The Office of Protected Resources of NOAA, of National Marine Fisheries Service, does have jurisdiction to make sure that damaged parts of the environment are being looked after. I say looked after because some of these things can't be cured, but at least right now there is attention being marshaled to medicate the animals that are suffering.
Mm. This is Focus. Our guest this morning, Christopher Stone, author of Should Trees Have Standing? Law, Morality, and the Environment. We have a couple of listeners who are ready to join the discussion this morning, so let's go and take a call. Our first caller this morning, Edgewood, line one. Hi.
Yes. Perhaps I'm a little off the topic, but the EPA and OSHA get constant barrages from the right wing on emails and other stuff that I get constantly. Yet they don't point out specific problems, but they just kind of think that any government program is something wrong. Rather than making specific charges, it's just a general right wing thing that seems to be against the EPA and such. How do you respond to that? Because it's just like anybody who's for the environment must not be for America.
Yeah, it's surprising that the disdain for environmental regulation or environmental concern should be associated with the right. Conservatives have, at some period of American history, under Teddy Roosevelt, I suppose, been interested in conservation, of conserving the environment. The environment might be conserved for people who can use it, who tend to be actually people who have relatively high incomes, and can get away on vacation and travel to national parks more than people of low income. It is a bit of a puzzle, but I think you've provided the answer. That there is objections to the EPA and to OSHA, which actually is for workers, arises from an anti-regulation bias, and just because it's part of the government gadgetry, they're opposed to it. It doesn't mean that they have no feelings for the environment.
Does a listener want to follow up?
Well, perhaps I'm way off the subject when I go with OSHA, but I worked in a factory as a summer job back in the 1970s, and many of the workers there had come from a previous factory in the printing industry from Dayton, Ohio, and they had worked there, obviously, since the 40s and 50s, and many of them were missing fingers and things because there were no regulations back then. So, I was able to observe firsthand that these regulations do make a big difference in people's lives. When you're missing a finger or two, and I'm sure I didn't see the people who were injured the worst in previous mm-hmm. times before that, it does make a difference, and doesn't make a difference to the very wealthiest in this country.
What was the attitude of the workers towards OSHA?
They were union workers, OSHA is wrong.
Or the Occupational Safety and Health Administration.
Yeah, there's generally a negative attitude toward OSHA, but by gosh, if you work in one of those companies and you see people who have suffered those injuries in years before, and now they have regulations that make you put guards on the rollers and things like that, where people used to get their fingers caught in, that's just regulation. But it saved people's fingers. And I mean, really, that can have a lot of effect on a person's life. And we're all human beings. And we're not just working for the company.
Yeah, I think that there's some resentment about the rules on the view that it increases the cost of manufacture in the United States vis-a-vis potential imports from other countries that don't have as many protections. I think that's part of the total picture that feeds the attitude towards regulations of worker safety and regulations of the environment and regulations of all sorts.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and we're going to go now to a listener in Plano, line 4. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I kind of disagree with some of what that gentleman said. He's picking on one group of people, and we ought not to do that. I think we're all in the same boat. We all live on this planet. We all got to keep it clean. I used to work for the Forest Service for years, and you want to see destruction firsthand basis, but then they don't want to pay the workers doing a government job. And I want to respond to somebody else, something said here, according to the same, kind of around the same idea, is a couple weeks ago somebody said that government workers are lazy and fat, and they don't want to, all they want to do is collect paychecks wrong. I bust my hump. I did a lot of volunteer work. I've got probably about 18 to 20 years working, plus then jobs more of volunteer work, and I see firsthand on a regular basis what people do to the environment. And it's not just a conservative or a liberal. It's everybody. There's a lot of hypocritical people out there, and I've seen this from people with big money that want to complain about, they want to drive their SUVs, but they don't want to pay the $10 gallon gas for, you know, for a gallon of gas. And you know, it's either we break the bank, and I firmly believe this, the only way you're going to get people to understand environmental issues is to start charging people double what they're paying now for things that cost the environment, right?
Yeah, I think that there should be a gas tax. I think that the that a tax on gasoline that attempts to measure the damage that each gallon causes the environment would be a good thing. I think most people who do economics think that's that.
I'm a contractor myself, and I recycle pretty much most of what I do. I'm not like the big guys. By myself. The whole plan was to hire a couple of guys, but I've always been this way, conscientious about leaving anything in the environment. The problem is we've kind of closed down landfills now. It's getting more costly for me to get rid of stuff now. Because I'm a contractor, they want to label me. They want to basically, OSHA has came out, or the APA just came out a couple months ago, stating that you have to be registered. Every contractor or anybody does any kind of home remodeling has to be registered with the EPA, and it has to go through such a rigorous training course in lead remediation that it's insane. It costs me. You know, one hand they want to be environmentally safe, but at the other hand they want to shut the little guy down. Now, but at the same time they're telling people if you're a homeowner, you could do the job and you won't have any problem. Plus, where do you get rid of it? There's no spot. You ask landfill people, you ask your refuse people, nobody knows where to put this lead. And it's all stemming from kids getting poisoned by lead. But it's not, to me, they're not looking at the issue. The issue is the kids are getting lead from things we're buying from other countries. It's a fact. It's not from American things. It's from other people from other countries. And my beef is, okay, now they're going to put everything on the homeowner. And I don't trust OSHA because I've worked with them too. And I agree with the gentleman who called before me. But at the same time, you've got to realize these guys know what they're doing. I was a firefighter for years. If I get killed or if I hurt myself on the job, is he going to come back and tell me, well, you knew, you know, it's your fault. We got to do this, this, and this. I could bring up half a dozen things like that. The issue is people are not educated. They don't know what they're doing. They go about their daily lives throwing things in the trash can they ought not to. And until we fix the people that are causing this, which means the manufacturer of all the baggies out there. You know, the hefty bags, that's plastic. That takes, like, what, 10,000 years to break down? You know, things like that, the sandwich bags.
I'm going to jump in, caller, and let our guest respond because there are so many issues that you've put out on the table.
Well, there's just one really very, very good central issue there. I think that's right, that the caller isn't objecting to regulation and recognize that some regulation may be good, but the regulators are subject to a great deal of criticism, and It's one thing to tell people they've got to cut down on lead, and lead has to be handled, you know, carefully. It can damage the environment, damage human health, but there's got to be clearly identified processes, procedures for storing it. And I think this is it's a very good point that's been raised.
Yeah. I think the listener also raises the issue of environmental literacy. We say we want to do good by the environment, but yet it's hard to put that ideal into practice.
Celeste, that's exactly right. And one of the motivations behind my book, the Should Trees Have Standing thesis, is that if a suit is brought to court in the name of an animal, that it's being threatened by this sort of environmental despoilation of which the call-in was speaking, it takes an abstract issue and seats it in a sea lion that you can visualize or a whale that you can visualize, and that increases the ability of the public to that literacy of which you speak. They get a sort of literacy in the sense that that the lawsuit gets attention, and that attention enables people to see this is what we're doing. We're killing these animals. Millions, tens of millions of waterfowl may be destroyed as a result of this oil spill, and then you see pictures of the waterfowl, or pictures of bears, polar bears that are being threatened in the Arctic. This all contributes to literacy, and by increasing the flow of cases to court, the attention that those cases get in court has the effect, whether they win or lose, of increasing of dramatizing the risks and increasing the literacy, as you put it, of the public.
Mm. Would you tell us about the sea lion you went to bat for in court?
Well, we're still going to bat for him. There is, as you said at the beginning, Celeste, there are a number of statutes that protect the environment, and one of those statutes is the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And the Marine Mammal Protection Act gives quite a bit of protection to a range of marine mammals in the U.S. jurisdiction. Generally, you can't tamper with them or interfere with them in any way. There is a limited exception that if sea lion is eating an endangered species, what do? You have the Endangered Species Act on the one hand, protecting endangered species, and the Marine Mammal Protection Act on the other, protecting individual marine mammals. And one of those individual marine mammals, a sea lion, starts eating salmon, endangered salmon. The law provides that a sea lion that has contributed to the reduction of the stock of an endangered species of salmon shall be executed. And there was a sea lion named C657 who had been nestling at the foot of the Bonneville Dam between Washington and Oregon and had been identified eating a sea lion, and therefore under a one-strike rule was to be shot. And I and some other lawyers brought a suit on behalf of the sea lion, naming the sea lion as plaintiff and citing to the law, which says that individually identifiable pinnipeds, sea lions, which are having a significant negative impact on the salmon, shall be shot. Because the salmon, the sea lion wasn't getting protection. And we're in court right now over that.
And
we're arguing that a sea lion that eats one or two salmon is hardly doing much damage to the total run of salmon, which are being interfered with much more by hydropower, by human sports fishermen, by all sorts of salmon fishers.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you could make the argument that this sea lion essentially has been entrapped because he didn't put the dam there.
That's right. And he's been also has what we'd call in law a prescriptive right. The sea lions have been eating salmon going up the Columbia for thousands of years. And we came, we're the latecomers here, and built the dam. And they're now still at the Columbia River mouth and still eating salmon. And the National Marine Fisheries Service says that the most the sea lions all together are eating no more than 4% of the annual run. And the rest is being killed by humans in ordinary human ways. Bringing this case has drawn a lot of attention to what's happening, because people don't know what's happening. And when a lawsuit is brought like this, and there are pictures in the Oregon and Washington press in particular of the sea lion or a sea lion, they begin to make the connection, and it dramatizes the plight of the environment, and people make the kind of points you just made, that why shouldn't the sea lions have priority? Why should humans have priority? We have other things to eat, and sea lion, they can choose to eat other things, and it's part of the sea lion's diet.
At the same time, you could say, shouldn't somebody be standing up for the salmon? And I guess the National Marine Fisheries are, but...
Well, the salmon are protected in a slightly different way. The protection of the salmon is for the species of salmon, whereas the protection of marine mammals goes to individuals. So that until the whole species is in trouble, the law holds its hand. You know, checks it, won't intercede, and the protection of the salmon can well be maintained by limiting sports fishermen. We could limit sports fishermen. We could limit the commercial fishermen. We could limit the tribes. I would think that the tribes and the who have a certain claim in the quota, that the tribes and the sea lions should have priority. And giving them priority in reducing the catch of the commercial fishermen and the sports fishermen would result in the same flow.
Yeah, interesting. Of course, that cooperation is difficult to win, I would think.
The quotas are established by the government, but the government, of course, is under more pressure from the sports fishermen than from the environmentalists. By bringing this case, which has gotten certain publicity, the hand of the environmentalists has been strengthened, because the case has become a bit of a rallying point for those who favor the environment.
So where is sea 657 today?
In suspense. He's in an aquarium in Texas, still under a cloud of law. As long as the aquarium will keep him, he's we presume, safe. Being fed salmon, as I understand, but they may be frozen salmon from some other species of salmon. But the case is going ahead to lift the cloud of the law off him.
And what of other sea lions still gnashing on salmon there in Oregon?
Well, and in trouble. There is a website your listeners could check out called the Sea Lion Defense Brigade, and they keep tabs on the status of different sea lions. But the sea lions are being harassed, meaning their steps are taken to get them away from the dam, to force them out of their preferred area, and others have been marked for execution, have been trapped and marked for execution. So the executions are continuing.
Mm. This is Focus. Our guest this morning is Christopher Stone. He's a professor of law at the University of Southern California and the author of Should Trees Have Standing? Law, Morality, and the Environment. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments. You can join us with a phone call. The phone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. And you also could join us by email. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, should trees have standing is a question you posed to some students of yours some 35 years ago in the 1970s. How did it come up?
Well, I was teaching the basic property course, and property, our notions of ownership, have evolved enormously over millennia. There's been changes in who can own things, married women, can they own property, can they inherit property, what sorts of things are ownable, real estate, personality, other people, slaves, and things like that. And I was trying to make the point that these developments in what was ownable and who could own affected the consciousness of the people in the societies involved. Our consciousness of mortality changes with the ability to control the flow of property after death. And in trying to illustrate what a radically different consciousness would look like, I rather spontaneously threw out the idea that nature could have rights, trees could have rights, rivers, why don't rivers have property rights and protection? And after I did, the native reaction was, that's just off the wall. And the class ended, and I went outside in the hall. I remember thinking, what did I just say? How could something in nature have standing, have a right? And I went up to my office and made a list of what would that mean to have a river have a right. And I thought, well, one, the suit would be brought in the river's name, and two, the damage would be to the river. We'd measure the damage to the river and its ecosystem. And three, an award by the court would go to the benefit of the river. In other words, the present law will protect a river to some extent, but only to the extent that some human being who's a what we call a riparian, who's got property on the river, suffers from the pollution. So if an individual human suffers from pollution, the human can sue for the damage done to the human. But the damage done to the river isn't accounted for, except indirectly. So I said, that's what you need to make the sentence even meaningful, that the river has rights, that a river has standing. And I asked my library whether there was any such case, and it turned out that there was one pending in the courts at that very moment. The Walt Disney Enterprises had a proposal to develop in the Mineral King Valley of California, development to put in some residences and amusement parks and things like that. And the Forest Service was dealing with the question whether or not to grant the permit. It had granted the permit, and the Sierra Club had complained, had sought standing to challenge the forest permit on behalf of the Mineral King, to say we're suing, we want to stop the permit. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had said, you can't do that, Sierra Club, you're not injured. Standing goes to someone who's injured, and the club isn't injured. And so I thought, why not advocate my theory with respect to this case, to say that, well, if the Sierra Club wasn't injured, I can see that, why don't we bring the suit in the name of Mineral King, of the valley itself? Because after all, the concern was not for the Sierra Club. The concern people had was for Mineral King and what the development of the valley would do to the ecosystem of Mineral King. And I was able to get the article done relatively quickly, and Justice Douglas endorsed it before the Supreme Court, although in a dissent, and two other justices who would have found standing for the Sierra Club also agreed that they would have given standing under my theory for the for Mineral King.
Yeah.
And that's how it got. That's how it sort of got launched. And then there was a great deal of publicity at the time because it was he was a zany law professor, amiably zany it seemed, who was speaking for the environment and for squirrels and trees and things like that. So it drew a certain amount of attention.
Yeah. I've got a listener who wants to join us here, and I'm going to get to that caller in just a second. But, you know, you mentioned that this question came up in a property law class. And, you know, you got out in the hallway after this lecture and you said, man, that was off the wall. And I suspect some people listening may be wondering, if trees have standing, could I cut one down? What about livestock?
Sure.
What about lab rats?
Absolutely. No. You can't. The answer about the single tree is, of course, a tree, no one's saying you can't cut a tree, but a tree could have rights. Some people have left in their estate provisions to maintain a tree. And the laws of some jurisdictions have recognized those trusts on behalf of the tree. To say that nature has rights isn't to say that everything in nature has rights. Or, you can cut down a human being. You can execute a human being, too. But a certain amount of due process is required before we can execute a human being. The prosecutor's got to go through a lot, get a jury to unanimously decide on guilt, and then have a hearing on the death penalty. So you can execute a human being, but there's a tremendous amount of due process. Now take the sea lion. The federal law provides due process for the sea lion. It isn't that we've made it up. It's in the law. It's in the Marine Mammal Protection Act that says before you can execute, provides for execution, but before you can execute a sea lion, it's got to be identified. You've got to make sure that that's the sea lion who is having a significant impact on the run of the endangered species. So the rights are a matter of degree, and we can provide, as we believe the Marine Mammal Protection Act provides, for a certain amount of protection for a sea lion. There's certainly no protection for an individual tree, but if someone has set up a trust for a tree, then the trustee of the tree should see that, has a legal obligation to see that the tree is fertilized, trimmed, kept in good health.
Let's take that call now. A listener waiting for us in LaSalle County, line 4. Hi.
Hi. I don't really understand the concept of beings and creatures and inanimate objects such as Lake Michigan having rights outside of the context of restricting other human beings' ability to utilize these, say, trees or lakes or fish or sea lions. If you tell me I cannot kill the sea lion that kills the salmon, you're not protecting the sea lion or the salmon. You're telling me I can't do something. It's a human interaction. The sea lion cannot go into court and advocate for itself. The sea lion cannot have rights. What only human beings can have rights. And other in the political social milieu that we live in, we decide how we are going to utilize our resources between you and I. If I want the salmon to live and you want the sea lion to live, we're going to have to go into court and determine which has priority in a human sense, because these creatures cannot go into court and advocate that they are not equals to us.
Yeah, good points. Let me answer the two that you raised. They're really good. One, that even though the sea lion can't speak, the sea lion can be represented by a lawyer who can speak. And the same is true of people who, of infants, of people who are senile, of trusts. Someone speaks for them. So it's possible, even though the sea lion can't speak, for the sea lion to go to court. I tell you, the sea lion is in court and is on appeal, and there's a whole bunch of cases.
But you cannot restrict.
I'll pick up your second point, because it's good too. There's plenty of cases that are brought on behalf of species, of loggerhead turtles, things like that. They can be brought. It takes a lawyer to bring them. Now, the other point you made about there's the sea lions on one hand and there's the salmon on the other, who should prevail, it's not a question of you and me. It's a question here of Congress. When there are disputes over rights, when there are potential conflicts, the law is made by the legislature. So in a case like the one that I was referring to with in discussion with Celeste about the sea lions, Congress has provided a balance. Congress has said that that sea lions and marine mammals are protected. And when they're protected, there is a trustee for them. In fact, there's an Office of Protected Resources within the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the Office of Protected Resources has the authority and has the obligation to go to court if someone is endangering, let's say, whales that are passing through U.S. waters, if people who take whaling watching craft too close to whales and interfere with the whales, they can be sued by the trustee for the whales, the National Marine Fisheries Service Office of Protected Resources. So in many cases, the conflict is guided by laws fabricated in the Congress or in the state legislatures.
Just one point. I'm not in favor of harming whales, but I accept a restriction by the state that says I'm not allowed to bring motorized craft within so many yards of a whale because I acknowledge my position in society and that our society makes determinations upon collectively what we value, be it whales,
yes,
or sea lions or salmon. Now, they had a case at the Ballard Locks in Seattle about 20 years ago where these sea lions were coming right to the locks on the Lake Washington Salmon Run. And the locks, if people are not familiar, from the Puget Sound, the salmon would go through the Ballard Locks into Lake Union and then into Lake Washington and the tributary streams.
Yeah.
The Salmon Run was probably down to 3% of its pre-Columbian numbers. But these sea lions were killing the salmon as they were climbing the locks. So they were flying these sea lions down to California, capturing them. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, they'd be right back. And so you have to decide, look, are we going to protect when there's hundreds of thousands of California sea lions? They're not endangered anymore. They're protected, but they're not endangered, whereas the salmon are endangered. Now, these are human values. These are not the salmon's values. These are not the sea lion's values. It is to us to determine the value of the salmon, that the salmon run versus the several sea lions that were killing the salmon. And I'll hang up and listen. All I want to say is these are human values. These are not salmon values and sea lion values. And a tree cannot go to court. But you can tell me not to cut down the sequoia tree because of our human values. Thank you.
Yeah, first of all, I agree with those points. They're very well put. The only parts of nature and total nature that can value are people. And the law reflects people's values. We can't. We vote. We humans elect Congress people. And humans inevitably are establishing the balance. The balance between different aspects of nature and other aspects of nature shift somewhat with the consciousness in the society. People like the caller do tend to favor whales over other things. Marine mammals do have a certain favoritism. People can picture marine mammals seem closer to them than salmon do. People don't identify with salmon as much. But at some point, as the salmon as an endangered species and a species of some commercial value to humans declines, there is going to be a shift in the rights of the legal position, let's put it if you want, of the marine mammal, and the legal position of the salmon is going to shift. And the caller is exactly right that the California sea lion is not in decline, and the salmon are in decline, and the if the particular salmon that are being eaten by the sea lions gets too low, then we've got to decide what to do. Okay, what to do? One thing to do would be to start shooting sea lions. Another thing to do is not shoot the sea lions, but reduce the commercial catch, to reduce the quota for the tribes, to reduce the sports fishermen. Now, as between the sports fishermen and what they're taking and the sea lions, what they're taking, I would cut back the sports fishermen. Other people would feel differently, and the way we decide that is first go to Congress, and secondly, the administrative agency, the National Marine Fisheries Service, would make some decision about the balance between the sea lions and the commercial fishermen. And if one side or the other, the people favoring the sea lion or the people favoring the commercial fishermen, feels aggrieved by the resolution of the administrative agency, then you go to court. And right now we're in court, and some of us are representing the sea lions, and some of us are, some other lawyers are representing the state of Oregon, and they're making pretty good arguments, and we're making pretty good arguments, and we'll see what the Court of Appeals says. But I don't want to lose sight of the point that the caller is exactly right, and it's importantly right, that ultimately, humans are making values, but human values can change, and the law can be part of the process that alerts and awakens consciousness in people so they feel more passionately about the environment, about different parts of the environment, and shift their concern from one interest group to another interest group. But it's always going to be humans making that decision.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hey, hi. You know, this may be sort of somewhat dealt with by your response that you just made, but I was just sort of playing this out kind of in a hypothetical in my own mind. If trees and animals and whatnot have legal standing and legal rights, do we, you know, if we extend that and think about, well, the conflict between different species, does that mean that, you know, if one... You know, if the lion kills the wildebeest, do we have to bring the lion up on charges of murder? And how do we, you know, just, I mean, it's obviously a hypothetical thing. I just was trying to think about the practical implications of this theory as it extends out beyond just protecting species.
Yeah. Let me say first, to give something in nature standing isn't to say that it's going to win. I should be clear on that. Standing means you can get in the courthouse door and make your argument. And we're in we're trying to get in the courthouse door in Oregon to make an argument on behalf of the sea lions. Now, as far as the lion or one animal eating another, that's not part. The law is not going to sue the lion because the lion has no choice. The law is only going to come in with an injunction, and you can't enjoin a lion. There have been cases in which an endangered species in Hawaii, just take one case called the palila case. There's a strange bird called the palila, and the palila was losing its habitat because of feral goats in Hawaii that had been sort of imported. So you had your sort of collision between the palila, the birds, and the goats. Who's to win? And you're saying, you know, what do you do? Well, there, Congress had made the palila an endangered species, but the feral goats weren't at all endangered. So in court, a suit was brought in the name of the palila as plaintiffs. And the palila won, and the palila were able to win because of the preceding act of Congress, which had provided that protection for endangered species and gave priority to the endangered species. But as between the lion and the wildebeest, that's just nature. There's no moral agency. You can't argue to a lion. A lion can't exercise moral judgment But humans can exercise moral judgment. It's up for humans to say, do we want to shoot sea lions, or do we want to withdraw the catch of sports fishermen who are spending their vacation catching salmon, and catching more salmon, I believe, than the sea lions are. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate the question.
This is Focus, our guest this morning, Christopher Stone. He's the author of Should Trees Have Standing? He is a professor of law at the University of Southern California at the School of Law there. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments this morning. Join the discussion with a phone call, 333-9455-800-222-9455. We also have an email address. You can join us by email this morning, will-talk@illinois.edu. It has been a long time since I took Business Law 101, but I'm wondering how we got to recognizing a corporation as a person.
Yeah, the corporations became persons within the law very gradually. They became persons within the meaning of the 14th Amendment before ex-slaves did. One of the early cases under the 14th Amendment, which says it gives rights to every person, was applied to protect corporations. Corporations for a long time could not be guilty of crimes because they had no mind of their own. They couldn't have criminal intent. Hmm. And that didn't begin to shift until the late 19th, early even 20th century in different states and in the federal courts. Corporations still aren't complete persons under the complete protection of persons, that would mean, under the Fifth and Fourth Amendment. There's still questions there about the rights of privacy of corporations. Mm-hmm. But since corporations have become such important actors in the society, it's become practically required to make them persons in the sense of make them tortfeasors or criminals. The alternative would be, suppose you have a company like British Petroleum, BP, which I assume has tens of thousands of shareholders. If you couldn't sue BP, if you couldn't treat BP as a, quote, person, the alternative the law would have ready would be to say, well, you've got to sue all the individual shareholders. You'd have to be bringing suit against tens or hundreds of thousands of people across the world. So it's much easier to manage the legal system, and it's actually, I think, to the benefit of plaintiffs as well as to investors, that the corporation be regarded as a quote, person. But one of the arguments I made in Trees was that, just the point you did now raise, that we once thought it was sort of funny that a corporation should be a person, that a corporation could commit a crime, and gradually we've accepted it. The law treats ships as persons. Suits are brought in the name, ships are regarded in the feminine. The courts refer to them as she, and then a suit can be brought against the ship. If a ship has been engaged in piracy, though the ship has a moral volition, the ship can be what we call libeled. Is sued to be brought back into a harbor and seized in a suit brought in the name of the people against the ship. So the law deals with a lot of funny entities, and dealing with animals or species as an entity, as a jural entity, isn't so very peculiar.
I want to go back to the op-ed piece that we talked about a little bit earlier that you wrote for the Washington Post. In that piece, you noted rivers do not have deep pockets.
Yeah.
So, what is the process if a river can get through the doors of the courthouse? What's the process for defending that or standing up for that river's rights, so
well,
to speak?
Well, it takes. I raised the point about rivers having not having deep pockets, having shallow pockets. to sort of assure people that, of course, there's not going to be a suit on behalf of every tree, because lawyers value their time. And just to sue on behalf of a tree, you'd have to have some good reason to sue. And to sue on behalf of a river, you can't just keep pasting, you can't go around pasting complaints in every jurisdiction through which a river flows, because it's expensive bringing a lawsuit. Now, who does pay when there's a good lawsuit? It's going to be some environmental NGO. People contribute to the Sierra Club or the Humane Society, some group of that sort. And the attorneys for that group are paid by donors who believe that the environment should have a stronger voice in the court system.
Hmm. We're running out of time. In fact, I think I'll just ask one last question here as a way of summing up. Do you think the public outrage we're seeing now at the spill in the Gulf of Mexico will affect the future of the question, should trees have standing?
Yes. I think it's really been a major event in people's consciousness, and they're going to see further evidence of what humans can do to the environment, of what our footprint is. And I hope and believe that there will be further legal protections, both in legislatures and in the courts.
Yeah, okay. And I have so many other questions, but we'll have to leave it there. Maybe we'll talk at another time, some other day.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to your callers.
You're very welcome. Christopher Stone has been our guest in this portion of Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn. Christopher Stone's book, Should Trees Have Standing? Law, Morality, and the Environment, now available from the Oxford University Press in paperback. It is the third edition of the book, Should Trees Have Standing?